Canada, our home and native land.
What's native about it, Canada?
Ah!
Just saying.
Oh, Canada, the land of movie tax breaks.
Very true, very true.
Why do you think so many things are filmed in Canada? The tax write-offs are amazing.
Thanks, Canada. Welcome back to Kicking and Streaming, where we couldn't pick our noses without written instructions.
I'm Carrie.
I'm Ross.
And this week we are covering the 1974 holiday slasher classic, Black Christmas.
Oh, guys, welcome, little onions. Hi, main feed. We're doing Christmas horror for this holiday season.
I've been wanting to do this category for a while.
I know.
Because I don't know if y'all have noticed, but there are quite a few horror movies that take place at Christmas.
And we're running out of Christmas shit to do.
Yeah.
So
Ross won't do any of the Christmas movies with comedians he doesn't like in them.
Okay. Before we get started,
don't forget, you can go follow us on Twitter at Kick and Stream.
KicknStream. And it's only those foul Tim Allen Santa Claus movies. Go on.
You can write the show at kickingandstreamingpodcast@gmail.com.
That's with an and, not an ampersand. He's not funny, and they're cringe as fuck.
And don't forget, folks, please be practicing the three R's this holiday season. Rate, review, retweet.
Rate, review, retweet, folks. We want everyone to come and join our little holiday slasher watch party.
And guys, big news if you haven't heard yet.
That Tim Allen is awful?
Yes, that.
Sorry.
I think we do know that in our heart of
hearts.
What's
the big news?
The big news is that on our Patreon right now, we have officially begun coverage of Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy.
We are doing long-form content for you over on the Patreon. So go over there and get you some content. That was a bad New Zealand accent.
For just $5 a month, guys, if you sign up right now, you're signing up for thousands of minutes of content.
Yeah, guys, you're going to get everything we've already put out on the Patreon. It's just $5. Five easy dollars a month. You get two guaranteed posts a month. And guys, like she said, we're doing long form right now. That's going to take us through the end of the year. That's going to be three tidy two-hour episodes for you to listen to. So
it's a big value for just $5.
Commuters, desk job workers, unite! Get on over to the Patreon. Please tell a friend. We have 11 members. And I'm one of them. I had this fledgling conversation with Carrie Ann. I kind of want to leave Twitter.
I know.
Because I did yesterday. I didn't leave it. I just deleted the app. I have to get... It is a cesspool. I don't know. We're going to have to rethink our social media strategy because somebody... me has not done a great job of it, but to those of you that do listen and listen every week, we love you so much and we're so happy to have you here with us this holiday season, especially for Christmas horror.
Woo!
My mother's taking a place up at Mont Holly. Does anyone else want to come?
Yeah, sounds like fun.
Great. How about you, Claire?
No thanks, Barb. I've made some other plans.
We're just having a little party.
Hey, quiet! It's him again! Jingle
bell, jingle bell rock.
Listen, you pervert, why don't you go over to Lambakai? They could use a little of this.
Jingle bell square in the frosty air.
I was supposed to meet my daughter here. Her name's Claire Harrison. Do you know her?
I'm sure you'll find her at the fraternity house.
Have you seen Claire today? No one knows where she is.
No, not since last night.
Hello? Hello?
Some of the girls are over here today, but I haven't seen Claire.
Well, what the hell are you planning to do about it?
90% of the time, girls are reported missing from the college. They're at a cabin somewhere with a boyfriend.
A high school girl's been murdered.
Claude?
Christmas is here, bringing good cheer to your little feet on the floor.
I
really don't think it could be Peter.
Well, he's obviously upset about something. I'd like to talk to him. Can you tell me where I might reach him?
The caller is in the house.
Come on, this is a sorority house, not a convent.
Are you up there?
Jess?
You can't rape a townie.
All right, Carrie. There is a lot to talk about, but guys, Black Christmas from 1974, a little treat for you to open up a Christmas horror month because we're going outside the timeline.
Yep, I know that I tend to hold a hard line with that 1980 cutoff, but...
Yeah, we don't do anything on this show really before 1980, but we've done... We just did Halloween.
Yep,
which
we did.
Has been inspired by this film.
Uh-huh.
Very heavily, and that we're talking about today. And also, we did, you know, Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
We did that outside the timeline.
And... Yeah, and like, you know, guys, I know what you're thinking. There's a remake of this from 2006.
Why didn't they just do that?
Because this is a better movie.
It is a better movie. And guys, this is the first time I've ever seen Black Christmas. I know about Black Christmas. I know about the two famous moments from Black Christmas. I know about the urban legend about the babysitter and the man upstairs. But I've never watched this film start to finish. And apparently it's one of Carrie's comfort go-tos.
Yeah, comfort is a weird word, but you're correct.
Hey, some of my comfort canons are weird.
The Handmaid's Tale.
Hey, it's not about comfort. It's about content.
Uh-huh.
All right. All right, guys. Black Christmas, originally titled Silent Night, Evil Night.
Hey.
Or The Stranger in the House.
Yeah.
Guys, we've got Bob Clark. He's our director here with us this week. He is also notable for doing A Christmas Story from 1983, which is funny as fuck. And also, just to note, this is a Canadian production.
Mm-hmm.
This is... mostly Canadian actors, well, and British ones, but yep. If we know anything about the Canadians, they're always tied hand in hand with the British.
You put the Queen on your money.
You're British. Yeah, I'm kidding. Don't. Hey, Canadian listeners, we know you're Canadian.
It's okay. We know.
We also come from the same colonialist oppressors. not that we're, sorry, I didn't mean that to sound like, we're not oppressed. No. We're descendants of the oppressors, but like...
Yeah.
Wow. Sorry.
Just a lot of backtalk. A lot of backpedaling.
Oh my goodness. This film is inspired by the combination of two narratives here. One's a very well-known urban legend, and one is an actual murder spree that happened in Montreal, in Quebec, in 1943 over the Christmas holiday season.
Not in Quebec.
Yes, in Quebec, yes.
Oh.
Who has tried to secede from Canada 12 times. It's an actual Christmas movie. No, it's funny. It was released on October 11th, 1974, in Toronto only.
Uh-huh.
And then was released in the United States on December 20th of that year. It's a nice, tidy 100 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't keep us for too long. The movie made over $1 million when it came out.
Ooh, in 70s money. How many loonies is that?
Oh my God. The loonies and the toonies just have dollars.
Stop.
I don't know.
Leave the Canadians alone.
You're right. I think that's interesting. But of course, you have the urban legend of the babysitter and the man upstairs. And guys, if you ever want some great viewing options, maybe we'll drop a link. I think it's free on YouTube right now. There's this great documentary. Well, I don't know about great, but there's this documentary called Killer Legends. And it's about four different distinct urban legends that we all carry with us. And one of them, of course, is the babysitter and the man upstairs. And that is based off of the 1950 Chrisman murder in Columbia, Missouri.
Oh, no.
And it's exactly what it sounds like. A 13-year-old girl.
13!
Oh, we'll get into it later. A 13-year-old girl was babysitting a young couple's infant. And a man broke into the house, raped her, and strangled her to death.
Oh, God.
And there are several films that center around this urban legend in your film viewing lexicon of the babysitter and the man upstairs. The first one, of course, being Black Christmas, was uh-huh. the original one to take on the urban legend. There's also The Stranger, The Caller, or The Visitor. One of those.
One of those.
And then there's also famously from 1978, When a Stranger Calls.
With Carol Kane?
With Carol Kane, yes.
Who is known for everything except horror.
It's also known for its sequel from 1993, When a Stranger Calls Again.
Not again.
And it's also known for its remake, When a Stranger Calls, from 2006, which is how I got introduced to the urban legend of the babysitter and the man upstairs. I would watch that movie alone at home at age 14 or 13 or 12 or whatever. And I would have to call mom and be like, I watch When a Stranger Calls alone again. And she's like, buddy, don't do that, okay?
You gotta stop doing that.
Like, why are you doing that?
This movie is also how I learned about the concept of frogging.
Oh, yeah, frogging is very real. Not as prevalent today as it was back then, but it's real.
Well, that's the thing. Because frogging, I'll save you a Google, frogging, P-H-R-O-G-G-I-N-G, is the actual concept of a person moving into your house, breaking into your house, moving into your house, and living there completely undetected.
Which, I think, if you've listened to our coverage of Insidious, you know that that's like one of my
worst nightmares. And like, I remember Googling after I saw this movie, do people actually move into your house and live in there undetected? Like, is that an actual thing that happens? And frogging is what came up.
Yeah, no.
And you think, Ross, you think it's not as prevalent as it is today?
I've seen several bouts of footage on the internet of people actually catching the frogger.
Ross, there is a television series that is recent. It's a true crime series called Frogger, the Person Living in the Walls or something like that. It's semi-recent stories about people catching strangers living in their houses. And I'm like, no!
Like I said earlier, this film did heavily influence John Carpenter in creating the Halloween franchise, just in terms of its stylistic choices, such as the killer POV shots and the long panning shots of all the mundane horror that's going on. Since 1974, this film has been novelized by Lee Hayes in 1976, and it also has a remake, 2006, like we talked about, and there's also another very recent remake from 2019.
I just saw that for the first time, and I couldn't believe, 2019? We're like 4 years on, and I couldn't believe I hadn't even heard of it. And that story is very different, but they make lots of cool callbacks to the original film that you can definitely pick out if you know what you're looking for.
So this narrative focuses on this sorority house, I believe set in Canada. It might even very well be Toronto or Montreal or...
The police officers, their sidearms say Bedford.
That's Ontario.
Okay, so Ontario.
I'm pretty sure.
I wrote Connecticut, so I'm glad that...
Maybe it is in the U.S., but I think there are several hints in the dialogue that it definitely is in Canada, such as the use of A.
A.
Like,
oh.
E-H. Like...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Some of the accents are also pretty on the nose.
Maybe that's just attributed to the actors, but I'm pretty sure our setting might be Canada. This narrative is focused around these sorority girls in this sorority house. Listen to me. Sorority girls. Sorority women.
Pi Kappa Epsilon.
Oh, my God.
I had to look up. I knew most of it, but I had to look up Pi. Pi Kappa Epsilon.
Obviously on some university campus somewhere in the great white North America. And when one of their roommates goes missing, a bunch of shenanigans ensue. So, Merry Christmas, Little Onions. Let's scream. Folks, you might have guessed it, but we've got some names.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and do we ever. Portraying Jess, one of our sorority students, we have Olivia Hussey. Olivia Hussey is very notable for her Shakespearean portrayals.
Yeah, a lot of you will probably recognize her from ninth grade English when the teacher made you watch Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, Zeffirelli's 1968 adaptation of Romeo and Juliet.
Not her being a minor and being filmed nude.
Yeah, and she's Juliet Capulet, yeah. Well, mind you, the character of Juliet is how old?
Like 14?
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember because there is Nip in that movie.
Yeah.
And I remember my English teacher standing underneath the television ready to hold a piece of black construction paper over it.
Yes.
So she wouldn't get any letters from parents.
She was in Zeffirelli's Jesus of Nazareth from 1977 as the Virgin Mary.
I was going to say, let me guess.
Yeah. And she was also in Death on the Nile.
from 1978.
Wait, the Poirot story?
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
And that it's, well, it's actually Agatha Christie.
Well, yeah, I know, but it's a Hercule Poirot story.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's the detective.
She was in that movie with Maggie Smith
and
Betty Davis. Yeah.
Oh.
Fuck you, Olivia.
I've got to look that up sometime.
She's also notable because she is Audra Denborough in Stephen King's It from 1990.
Oh, the trauma.
And she has several voice roles in the Star Wars video games.
Really?
Yeah, Star Wars Rogue Squadron, Force Commander, and Old Republic.
Hey.
Portraying Peter, and holy fuck, we have Keir D'Elia. Keir, you've got a face.
Uh-huh.
And we'll be talking about it. But
I just saw him on an episode of Murder, She Wrote.
He is notable because he is astronaut David Bowman from 2001 Space Odyssey from 1968.
Wow, I can't do that.
And it's 1984 sequel, 2010, the year we made contact.
Oh, man.
I know. Portraying Barb, we have Margot Kidder.
I love Barb!
By the way, we're welcoming all these people to Kicking and Streaming, all except one, really.
Yeah.
And she is notable because she is Lois Lane in the Superman film series.
Yeah, from like the 70s.
78 to 87,
yep.
She was Lois Lane.
Absolutely.
With Christopher Reed. Oh my God, she was born in Yellowknife.
What?
Do you know where Yellowknife is?
Is it a remote part
it's
of Canada?
It's the capital of the Yukon Territory.
Oh, the Yukon's up there.
It is a place Yukon Cornelius. It is a place that you don't really get to unless you're on the Polar Express.
Oh my God.
Oh, like
the Yukon is only accessible by the Polar Express.
She is also notable because she is the original Kathy Lutz from the Amityville Horror in 1979.
I forget about that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Opposite Brolin, yeah.
Portraying Lieutenant Fuller, we have John Saxon. John Saxon has been in about 1,000 westerns.
He's got that face, that strong square jaw.
200 film and television projects during a span of 60 years.
I think the thing I recognize him from immediately is
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yes, he is. He's Heather Langenkamp's dad.
Okay. Gotcha.
And he plays cops a lot, too.
We've got Marion Waldman as Mrs. McHenry, or Mrs. Mack,
yeah,
as they call her. She's the house mother for, what was it, Phil?
Pi Kappa Epsilon. Epsilon!
Yeah, upper echelon, and... She's not hyperlinked, so hi, Marion. You're funny in this. Guys, please welcome her back to Kicking and Streaming.
The only returning actor.
Portraying Phil, and for short for Phyllis, I'm sure, and my favorite character.
Yes.
Again, this is the first time I've ever seen this movie, and she was my favorite character. We have the one and only Andrea Martin. She was with us when we covered My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
And when we covered the Jimmy Neutron movie.
Yeah, she's the voice of Miss Fowl, guys. This is 1974.
She's a baby.
She's a baby and a babe.
Uh-huh.
I gotta tell you. Oh, and we'll get into it. She's also, she voiced in Anastasia. She was, I got you a job in the fish factory.
Comrade
Fleming-Koff,
yeah.
Hedwig and the Angry Inch. She's also notable for her Broadway fame. Because she was Yenta and Fiddler on the Roof. She was, pretty sure she was Grandma Adams in the Adams Family. And she's also, she's most notable for being Frau Blücher in the original cast of Young Frankenstein on Broadway. And you got to meet her.
I did.
And you can absolutely fuck off.
I've got her autograph around here somewhere.
Yeah, why don't you make it worse? also the 2013 revival of Pippin. And guys, portraying the moaner, the caller, the voice on the phone, or Billy, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
We have Nick Mancuso. He's doing the voice. Portraying Billy's shadow is Bob Clark. I just say Bob Clark? Sorry, Bob Clark is the director. My bad. I'm sorry. That went over my head. And portraying Billy's POV, I guess the cameraman, is Albert J. Dunk.
Thanks, Dunk.
Yeah, thanks, Dunk, for doing that.
America runs on Duncan.
I also want to mention this caller, this moaner, this stranger person. He does several different voices, but he doesn't.
Yeah.
It's various members of the crew.
You think?
I don't think. I know for a fact.
Oh, you read.
Yes, I did.
Okay. It's,
yeah. Guys, stylistically, first time watching this movie, guys, I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it. I was hanging on the edge of my seat there for a minute, but folks, we've talked too long. Well, I've talked too long, and we absolutely must get into this content. Merry Christmas, little onions. Let's scream. Not the ominous silent night with the shot of the nice house at 6 Belmont at the beginning.
This is the sorority house for Pi Kappa Epsilon. They're having their annual Christmas party, you know, right before everyone goes away for the holidays.
The good old credits before the movie action going on here.
I love that we've kind of brought that back in recent years. Like, I don't know, it's just a good way to, I think, set you up.
With the POV shots of the infiltrator.
Not the heavy breathing.
It's very Michael Myers.
Yeah.
It's very Michael Myers. Because remember, when we talked about Halloween, that interesting take for John Carpenter at the very beginning.
It also opens with a POV shot.
Yeah, and this is 4 years before that. Canada has been ahead of us on so many things.
I know. Is this just a big love letter to Canada for you?
Oh, Canada. And it's no, it's not.
And I want to stress this from the beginning. This moaner, this man who we will be referring to as Billy for the most part, we never see this man. Not really. We get shots from his point of view, and we see shadows and things, but never once do we get a clear look at his face. And it's so intentional. The same reason we never get a really good look at Michael Myers. It's because seeing his face would humanize him in some way.
Yeah, right? Hitchcock and shit, right? There's nothing more terrifying than an unopened door and an unmasked creep, you know? Like...
an unmasked creep.
Also, these women are 30 years old.
Well,
a year in camp. Amalia sat down at the beginning to watch this with me, and she was like, these bitches aren't in a sorority. Look at them. They all look way too old to be in college.
People look older back then,
they
man.
They really did, dude. I saw... I'm sorry. You can cut this out if you want. I saw TikTok footage about this documentary that they followed an Appalachian family around for 40 years.
Uh-huh.
And this woman... in 1960, whatever the hell, is on camera, and she says she's 28.
Uh-huh.
She looks 54. And I'm like, you're 28? What are you talking about?
Oh, boy.
And he gets in that attic.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and the shots of the attic while this party's going on
downstairs. No, guys, he literally climbs the rose trellis up to the attic. That's how he gets in. And there's so much shit in this attic.
Justice for all the attics in the world. Clean those goddamn rooms out.
But, Ross, why are there so many things in this attic? This is a sorority house.
Oh, I have a note about this later.
There's a hobby horse up here.
I have a big note about this later. And
okay.
I think it plays into the deeper lore of Black Christmas.
Uh-huh.
Even though I don't know a lot about the lore of Black Christmas...
It is left deliberately ambiguous.
And there's a couple bit tidbits later on in the film I'd love to talk about. But the sweeping shots of the house immediately disconcert you. Because I know it's like, there's this thing about this film. It feels very, like, it's dramatic. It's cinematic, but also still very natural. I had this same note when we covered Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's this, I don't know. There's this is naturalness a word?
Naturality? That's not a
naturality.
Word.
We're making it a word. There's a naturality to this that is just pleasant. It doesn't take away from its cinematic or dramatic license, I should say.
Let's talk about our sorority sisters and some of their boyfriends.
Sure.
We'll begin with my favorite, Barb.
Barb. Oh, yeah, Margot Kidder, yes.
Barb, she is snarky. She is stylish. She is not afraid to tell a man where to stick his Yule log.
And she's drunk.
Yeah. We so would have been friends.
Oh, by the way, how come I was the only one there working tonight?
We were there this afternoon, Barb.
A likely story.
How's it look?
Yule-ish, very Yule-ish. Have you got your Santa Claus suit ready?
Yeah. What time do little bastards arrive?
About 1 o'clock.
My favorite part about her look in this opening scene is the black choker around her neck that just says yes on the front.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She's wearing a consent choker.
Guys, I love 70s women. There's something about them.
I know.
I want them to top me.
You said stop.
I'm sorry.
Oh my God.
I'm sorry.
And her holiday isn't going great because her mother is taking off with some boyfriend for Christmas instead of spending it with her. And so she's already surly and in her cups. And then we have Phyllis, or Phil.
Phil.
As she's known throughout. Phil is sweet. She's a little bookish, very sensible. And Ross, is this where you'd like to comment on how cute you think she is?
I will a little bit later on, but like, I like Phil. Phil's my favorite character. She was the person who was the most human throughout this entire thing, and that's why I love her.
She's also got herself a boyfriend named Patrick.
Who is your type.
A little bit.
I actually did write later on in my notes, so there's Patrick, your boyfriend, Carrie. Because if you were in, I'm sorry, Pi Sigma Echelon.
Pi Kappa Epsilon.
Apple Pie Absalom.
Yeah. No, yeah. I would be very into Patrick.
Yeah.
And so then we also have Claire. Claire is mousy, shy, prudish. She is like, I feel like she's the one in this sorority who doesn't necessarily get along with everybody super well.
Mm-hmm.
But she does have the best looking boyfriend, Chris. Mm.
Yeah, hi, Chris. I'd like to be a hockey puck.
He does play hockey.
He does.
Because this
is
Canada.
It's Canada.
You'd love for him to hit you with a hockey stick? Is that what you just said?
Are they called hockey sticks?
I don't know.
What's the actual instrument called? Hockey bat?
Hockey bat.
Hockey bat sounds wrong. Anyway. Who else? There's one more, Carrie. Who else?
And then we have our final girl, Jess. Jess Bradford. She's the only one I heard a last name on.
Final is the operative word.
Yeah, for real. I wrote, Jess is British for some reason.
Well, I mean, if we're led to believe the settings in Canada, that would make some sense.
I guess that makes more sense than if I thought it was in Connecticut, which I did the whole time.
You know, some people, like, you get into, like, upper Ontario, like Ottawa, more posh. Sometimes you have some people that sound British.
Okay.
Like, it just, that's just the way it is.
Hello? Pardon? Who? Bob, it's for you. Long distance.
Jess is very independent and friendly. She has a sophistication to her that's a little beyond the other women.
Every time she gets on the phone, she's at 1,000. Like, the first time that phone rings, hello? Pardon? Who? Like, I know she wasn't trying to be funny, but it is. Like,
I'm also always stunned by her silky black hair. Like,
oh, Carrie, the top.
The sweater!
With the hands on the boobs?
Yes!
I was
iconic.
Living for that. Living for it.
Jess does have a boyfriend named Peter, who is a music major.
I'm sorry if I hurt your ears when I did that.
Yeah, I'm kind of used to it. Peter's not at the party because he's working on his, like, thesis or something for the college conservatory. We'll get back to Peter.
Yeah, we don't care and you guys won't either.
Peter is fucking weird. If Facebook existed back then, their relationship status would be, it's complicated, for sure. And listen, I was never in a sorority, so I don't know if this is still a thing. But back in those days, if you lived in a sorority house, you had a house mother. Like an older woman who lived in the house and mentored the young women, many of whom were on their own for the very first time in their life, right? And that brings us to Mrs. McHenry.
Who Barb describes as the queen of vaudeville, 1891.
See, but she is an actual formal vaudeville performer. And like, she's marmish looking, but she loves her whiskey and her smokes and she loves her girls. She also has a little white cat named Claude.
Whatever.
She's supposed to be what passes for comic relief in this movie, but a lot of it kind of...
I'm mostly just uncomfortable.
Like... Yeah, I know.
So the phone rings, doesn't it,
Carrie? Oh, speaking of being uncomfortable, we have our first obscene phone call.
Guys, quiet down. It's the moaner.
Yeah, they've been referring to him as the moaner. Apparently this has been a repeating trend for the last couple of days, and I need y'all to buckle the fuck up.
Yeah, guys, it's not pleasant. Like,
and I'm going to spare you the worst of it, but this is some of the most vile and obscene dialogue I've ever heard in a film.
He's expanded his act. Could that be one person? No, Claire, that's the Mormon Tabernacle Choir doing their annual obscene phone call.
You know what makes me crazy about this?
What?
1974 is when Golden State Killer started.
Oh, yeah. He also used to call and, like, breathe.
Yeah.
And say vile things.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no.
This was my first favorite line. Could that be one person? No, Claire, that's the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, says Barb.
I love Barb because
it's the way they're entertaining it.
Well,
they're all just the pan of them all listening to it.
I think they're so horrified they can't even believe it's real.
Margot Kidder, Barb, not bad.
Oh, no, yeah, it's upsetting to everybody else, but Barb's not even fazed by it. She's like, he's expanded his act. And she finally...
I just wrote, that's enough. Like,
she finally yanks the phone out of Jess's hands and goes,
listen, you pervert, why don't you go over to Lamba Kai? They could use a little of this. Oh, why don't you go find a wall socket and stick your tongue in it? That'll give you a charge.
I'll stick my tongue up your pretty pussy.
You fucking creep!
I'm going to kill you.
Oh! And then the line goes dead.
He got super serious there at the end.
Yeah, and like, Ross, I don't even know what I would do. I know that nowadays we have... simpler.
We have the technology.
Yeah, we have simpler and faster ways of finding out who obscene phone callers are, but, like, Claire is especially upset by this because that obviously offended every one of her sensibilities. And the way Barb, I love Barb, but also Barb, don't be an asshole. She's actually making Claire feel bad about it, about how upset she is.
Yeah, no, this is the, what they don't know is that you like it moment of the movie.
Yeah.
You know, like,
really are too much, Barb. Oh, come on. This is a sorority house, not a convent. I'll see you later. I'm gonna go pack. Ugh. Hasn't she had enough trouble fitting in here without you getting at her all the time? Come on, I know a professional version when I see one.
I'm like, Barb!
Yeah. Claire is hurt by that, and Claire's leaving tomorrow to spend the holiday with her family, right?
Mm-hmm.
She's leaving campus tomorrow, and so she's like, I'm going to go pack. And this is where I wrote, okay, Claire, goodbye forever.
Yeah.
She's going upstairs, and she's never coming down. I know that immediately.
Yeah.
This is where I would like to start to talk about the color scheme in this movie.
Ooh, okay.
Have you ever noticed this before? Specifically, the color red and the color green.
Oh, okay.
Very Christmassy colors, right?
Yeah.
What do you, did you notice anything about what Claire is wearing?
She's wearing a blue sweater.
But she's got...
a red undershirt on?
She's got a red plaid skirt on.
Oh, okay,
put
yeah.
Put a pin in that.
Put a pin in that?
We'll come back to more of it later.
Claire is packing her suitcase while the rest of the girls are downstairs giving Mrs. Mack her Christmas gift.
Carrie?
Yeah?
Why does she have a literal squishmallow? on her bed.
It does look like a squishmallow.
It's a pumpkin.
Uh-huh.
And it's got a death stare on it. It looks like it's watching a murder happen.
It's about to.
I know. It literally is.
Because she's got that little light on in her closet, and she's pulling stuff out of the closet. She doesn't see it, but we can see it. Billy is in the closet behind the dry cleaning bag.
Just hear those sleigh bells jingling, ring, ding, jingling, do. Ah!
This film's soundtrack is also incredibly disturbing in its own right. When they're not using Christmas music, it's this tinny, disconcerting noise that sounds like someone has opened up the back of a piano.
Yeah.
And is just dropping things on the strings.
Which someone does that later in this movie, but like, you know.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Literally somebody does that. Claude?
Oh no, she thinks
someone's about to be Claude!
No, stop!
Sorry!
She thinks the cat is in her closet. And she's just getting closer and closer.
Claude? Who is that? Who is it?
And bam! bam, Billy wraps that dry cleaning bag around her face and smothers her to death. That's it for Claire. Like, it's so disturbing because no one downstairs is hearing this because there's so much excitement over Mrs. Mack and her little present. And Billy, completely unseen by anyone, throws Claire's body over his shoulder and goes up the attic ladder. Puts her in a rocking chair with that dry cleaning bag still wrapped around her face. And he is rocking her in the chair.
It's giving Spalding from Coven.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, or maybe Spalding from Coven is giving Billy.
Yeah.
Little baby bunting, daddy's gone a-hunting, gone to fetch a rabbit skin to wrap his baby in.
God! That fills me with dread.
The most mystifying thing about this whole movie for me is that there's a lore around Billy.
Yeah.
Billy, whatever Billy is manifesting and playing out in his own psychopathic mind on this occasion, we get most of it. Like, we get lots of shots throughout the movie of things he's doing in the attic.
Yeah.
While this whole debacle is going on. Not to mention all of the dialogue from his phone calls that he keeps making throughout the film. And guys, none of it is ever truly explained in this movie. I'm going to ask you about it at the end because I know you know what it is.
Well,
because it's expanded upon in the remake. And I, even if you don't have all the answers, I'm not trying to tell our listeners that you're going to have all the answers, but we're going to talk about it at the end, okay?
Yeah, I do have a note in the middle about it where I do explain how the 06 version goes too deep into it, but I can finalize it at the end.
I'd like to chime in real quick to talk about Mrs. Mack's alcoholism.
Oh, no.
First of all, she'd be hiding that shit in books in her office.
Yeah.
Like, literally cutting out pages to hide bottles of booze.
B4. Booze.
And then that when we have that cut to the bathroom where Mac is sauced at herself in the mirror.
Yeah.
And she takes the top off the toilet and pulls a string that then lifts another bottle of booze. Booze out of the commode is insane. That's alcoholism. If you're hiding it in the commode, it's officially alcoholism.
How old are you calling it a commode?
And I know. I did. 1974.
I know.
Anyway. And like, she's off her rocker. She is drunk.
Yeah.
And not that she's wholly responsible for all these girls. They're legal adults. Like, they're responsible for themselves. But
that's why she has to hide the alcohol, because they're not supposed to have it.
But, like, she rinses with it.
I know.
She rinses her mouth. Rinsing your mouth with liquor is insane.
Oh, yikes.
Ouch. And this is where I took the note. Okay, so next day?
Yeah, this is the next morning.
And before we move on to that next day, real quick, another color pin.
Okay.
Because I wrote, okay, so no one checked on Claire that night, but I remembered I was wrong because Jess, Olivia Hussey, kinda does.
Mm-hmm.
She goes to her door and knocks on it.
Mm-hmm.
And, but there's no answer, right? Because she's, yeah. And when she's knocking on the door, what's hung on the door? A green wreath with a red leaf.
Just a single red leaf?
Single red leaf. We have Mr. Harrison, right?
Yeah, the next morning, Mr. Harrison, Claire's father, is in town to meet Claire so he can bring her home for Christmas.
But she missed meeting up with him because she's very dead in the attic.
Yeah.
Sorry.
If you don't laugh about it, you'll cry.
Yeah.
So he asks another student where he can find the sorority. And I wrote, sir, how do you not know where your 20-year-old daughter is living?
You know what? Canada, they're very trusting.
Okay.
They'll cut off their leg and apologize to you for it. Like,
gotcha. He goes over to the sorority house and Mrs. Mack lets him in.
I'm very disappointed in this atmosphere. I intend to do something about it. I didn't send my daughter here to be drinking and picking up boys.
Oh, Claire's a good girl, Mr. Harrison. I wouldn't want you to get the wrong idea about that. She is a good girl.
Also, Claire's dad just hates that she's a young woman who is alive
and
existing. Like,
he resents not having, you know, that home body control over her.
There's a lot of counterculture displayed throughout this house because it's the 70s.
Yeah, like, and make love, not war.
It's women's liberation, like.
Not the picture of the naked people making the peace sign on her closet
which
door.
Which was a staple in many a college kid's dorm, like.
And Mrs. Mack is like, well, I really don't know where she is, sir, even though that's kind of my one job.
Yeah.
She's probably at the frat house where they're all having a party for underprivileged kids. And he offers to drive her into town on his way over to check the frat. And I hate this shot when they're getting in the car. It's a shot from the attic, out the attic window. You can see them getting in the car in the background and Claire's frozen dead little face in the foreground. And I'm like, holy shit, if they looked up, they might have seen her.
Might have.
Might have.
Might have. Don't look up.
And so I love this scene, however small it is, because we're at the fraternity house. And like we said, the girls and their frat brothers are giving a party for underprivileged children.
I did ask the question because I missed that.
Uh-huh.
And I kept asking the question in my notes. Why are all these kids in this frat house? Shouldn't they be at the mall? Oh, I'm sorry. It's 1974. Shopping center?
Yeah, no.
Like, why is Patrick being the Santa? He is cursing.
Oh, they've made Patrick be Santa. And he's so shitty because he's just learned that Phil is not going away with him for the weekend.
Yeah.
Phil is going with Jess and Barb to go skiing because Barb's mother took off with her boyfriend.
He calls her a bitch. I'm like...
No, the way he's sitting there with a kid on his lap.
Ho, 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 shit.
Santa, please.
Look, she's supposed to be going away with me for the weekend, goddammit.
Well, we decided that we would go skiing for a few days,
didn't we? Yeah, and I've been looking forward to this for 3 weeks. Bitch.
Isn't Santa naughty?
Oh, ho, ho, fuck.
Yeah.
That's such you energy. Ho, 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 fuck. And Claire's father shows up to the frat, no Claire, and he's on the phone with his wife saying, I haven't found her yet. And you can see Barb in the background giving a little boy champagne.
Yeah.
Barb!
Like.
And so, we have to talk about Peter, Ross.
Yeah.
Jess is visiting Peter at the conservatory where he's working on his musical thesis. And this is a very controversial topic in those times, but Jess tells him she is pregnant.
And she wants to abort it.
Yup.
And he doesn't want her to. And guess what? That does not matter.
It does not matter. A lot of men in those times would argue with you. A lot of men in these times would argue with you. But... literally not his choice.
She's supposed to come to this, I don't know, thing for him.
It's a recital.
Yeah.
He's going to play his thesis for the college board or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And, like, he's already wired because of the stress of that. And he just thinks he's a little musical genius and he's very controlling. He's very in love with her. She is not in love with him.
Yeah, no.
Every time he says, I love you, she says, I know.
I know.
Oof.
I want us to have a baby.
Peter, I can't.
Oh, Christ, Jess. Don't you ever consider anyone but yourself?
I've thought this out very carefully, and I know what I'm going to do.
Do you know how important this afternoon is to me?
Yes, I do.
Why don't you just get out of here?
So she leaves, like, I'm not changing my mind. You can get bent.
Yeah.
And she goes back to the sorority house and takes a shower. And this brings us to obscene phone call number 2. And this one is incredibly specific.
Oh, hell, not again.
Billy!
Billy? I'm sorry, you have the wrong number.
But your mother and I must know is... Where did you put the baby, Billy?
You've got the wrong number.
Where did you put Agnes, Billy? Billy.
Look, I'm telling you, you have the wrong number.
What your mother and I must know is... Billy!
I wrote, who the fuck is Billy? Who is Agnes? These are not names I've heard before. We'll talk about it, right?
Yeah, because the 06 movie really expanded on this. I think they expanded way too much. There's a reason we're not covering that movie this week. Now Barb, Phil, and Mr. Harrison are trying to report Claire as missing at the police station. And they are stricken with having to deal with this mouthy desk sergeant named Nash.
Yeah, he asks the... number, the telephone number for the sorority house, and Barb can't be serious for 1 second.
Yeah, sure. It's Fellatio 20880. Fellatio. It's a new exchange, F-E.
It's a new one on me. How do you spell it?
Back in those days, phone numbers had words.
Yeah, when did phone numbers get way less complicated?
But she tells him it's fellatio.
Yeah.
And Nash, I know why Nash has no idea what that is, but like, it just the way he writes it down so seriously. The other thing I never noticed about this scene is that Barb is cracking a beer in the middle of the police station.
Barb, can you take any of this seriously? Your friend is missing.
You know what? I think she feels guilty about it. I think she feels guilty about it.
What
and
they don't know is that you like it.
Uh-huh.
It's a very girl interrupted moment that they had earlier. Well, not that severe, but you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
And guys, it's 1974, so the police don't take this seriously, right?
No, absolutely not.
Because how dare you be a woman who needs accounting for, but also how dare you be out of a man's control?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, oh, these stupid women, they deserve to go missing. You know, they wanted it.
They
like,
probably just did a cabin with a boyfriend.
Literally shut the fuck up. I can't believe we pay you even beyond being a cop. I can't believe we pay you to be a cop and do nothing and then pay you a pension until you die.
Oh my God. I know. Speaking of controlling women, this is where I want to talk about this. This musical thesis that Peter has been strung out trying to finish, we get to see it.
Yeah, cut to Peter playing the piano. Badly.
Oh, guys, that's the thing. He thinks he's such a genius. He thinks this is so subversive. That board is dead behind the eyes.
We also get the close-ups of Peter's face.
Sounds like a piano falling down the stairs.
I literally can't.
And he's playing it with all the fervent energy as if he were Johann Sebastian Bach.
And it's just, we can tell this is not going to go well for him.
Of course not.
Also, real quick, we saw Jess interrupt Chris Hayden's hockey match or whatever.
I was actually just getting ready to talk about that.
And, you know, because she's going to tell him, hey, your girlfriend is kind of missing. Like, we don't know where Claire is. And so, I love this. Chris storms into the police station to say y'all are the reason civilization is failing in that sexy fur coat.
Oh, that gigantic brown fur coat. Like he is the warden of the North.
Like,
it's giving big Stark energy.
It's giving, it's honestly giving runway energy. Like,
yeah.
Why is no one ready?
Nash, you stupid son of a bitch. You got a big goddamn mouth.
What the hell are you talking about?
Hi, Chris. How's your brother?
Ken, I gotta talk to you.
What's up?
I want to know why nothing's being done about Claire Harrison being missing and why this idiot gets away with saying the things he does.
You're a friend to Claire Harrison?
Yeah, I've been taking her out.
This is not even an isolated incident today, because there has been another missing persons report made about a 13-year-old girl named Janice.
Uh-huh.
Who did not come home from band practice. And, like, the cops aren't really taking that seriously either.
The kids just went somewhere, you know, they were just playing. And I'm like, guys, it was a decade. It was a decade of this. The police just going, oh, this missing person's probably fine. There's no way they've been horribly murdered. And they were always horribly murdered.
It got so bad that they had to create a television PSA in the 80s that was like, it's 10 o'clock. Do you know where your children are?
No! No, they fucking don't. All they care about is getting off work, clocking out, getting their sifter and smoking their cigarettes until it's time to go to bed.
All right, Ron.
Sorry. Justice for Gen X.
So Fuller gets the file on Claire and actually starts putting some thought into this mess while Barb, Phil, and Mr. Harrison go back to the sorority house for some dinner because they can't really do anything else. No one has organized a search party yet or anything like that.
I've been catching some queer vibes. Did you catch any queer vibes? Have you ever caught any queer vibes during this movie?
From Barb?
From a couple characters, actually.
I mean,
Sometimes the ways. Also, I'm in love with Phil. I'm extremely attracted to Andrea Martin in this movie. Some of the ways Phil be looking at Jess.
Uh-huh.
I It's a little too dear.
It could also just be platonic.
Do you also notice what Barb is looking at in this scene before she starts drunkenly talking to Mr. Harrison?
Oh, no, she's looking at a Playboy centerfold.
Yeah.
Not a playgirl, a playboy.
No, yeah, it's like...
She's just got it out in front of everyone.
Before she starts drunkenly talking to Mr. Harrison about the turtle she read about that can screw for 3 days straight.
Oh my God.
Yeah, no. Also, I just love that Phil loves how outrageous her friends are. She has mom energy, but she doesn't act on it. And good for her.
Yeah.
You know, like, she's gonna act on it now, though, isn't she?
Yeah, because Barb has been drinking all day
and
long.
Accusing Mrs. Mack of blaming Claire's disappearance on her.
Yeah. Oh, it's too much.
And can I just tell you, during this scene, while Barb is drunkenly talking to Mr. Harrison, do you notice what she's wearing?
She's wearing a black dress with poinsettias on them. Or poinsettias? I've never pronounced that correctly.
What color are those?
Red.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I see what you're getting at.
We'll keep going. We'll keep going.
Okay, all right.
Mm-hmm.
You think that I drove her away? And if she's dead, you're going to blame me. Well, that's what we're all thinking. Why doesn't someone just come right out and say it?
Barb, dear, you've had too much to drink. Mr. Harrison...
I don't give a shit about Mr. Harrison. I'm sick and tired of everyone in this house insinuating stuff and not coming out with what they mean.
Barb, why don't you go upstairs and lie down for a while?
Shut up. And you leave me alone. God damn you. You think it's my fault, don't you? You've been implying it all afternoon.
Barb, you're drunk. Go to bed.
So Barb goes upstairs to sleep it off, and Chris and Jess come back to the house to let the others know that a search party's finally been organized for Claire and this missing 13-year-old out in the park, so let's head over there. And while Jess, Chris, and Phil and Mr. Harrison go on the search, Miss Mack is getting ready to leave for her sister's place.
Mack says to Phil, might not be here when you get back because I'm going to spend the holiday with my sister. First of all, you're gonna leave?
Yeah.
When one of your charges is missing? And then also...
Like you said, she's not legally responsible for them.
Yeah, I know she's not, but also I just immediately knew she was dead from the moment she said to Phil, I might not be here when you get back. And I also know that Barb is dead because Phil asked Mack to check on her before she leaves.
Yeah.
We'll get there. We'll get there. Also, Peter. Remember Peter?
Yeah.
We all know the recital didn't go well. And we can see that it's not gone well because he's destroying the innards of the piano.
With a microphone stand.
Yeah.
It's literally making the sound that soundtrack makes.
And so, like, after that display of violence, I'm like, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Is it Peter?
Mm-hmm.
I think it might be Peter.
Miss Mack is drinking. She's drinking a fifth and packing her suitcase.
What's she got on, Carrie? She's got a red hat on, doesn't she?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So what you're saying is the outfit, the wardrobe, is marking them. For
yes.
Death. Yes. Okay.
And,
all right.
And all the Christmas, like, in the red even goes beyond just what they wear. It's all throughout the house. It's a Christmassy color.
She hears Claude meowing up in the attic because he's nibbling on poor Claire's little deceased body.
Yeah. Time for Mac to die because Claude is in the attic. Gee, I wonder why.
And she wants to say goodbye to the cat before she leaves, so she climbs the ladder to the attic.
She's like, how the fuck did you even get up here?
That's a good point. How did the cat get into the attic?
Yeah, yeah, like I said, gee, I wonder why. And like when she's like looking around up in the attic and she's like, God, I can't see anything. But she can see something silhouetted against the window.
It's Claire in the rocking chair.
Yeah, it's Claire's dead body. And she turns around and there he is. He hooks her.
Yeah, Billy.
He hooks the hooks. The hooks me, boy.
I knew that was coming. I shit you not. Billy has a hook on a rope. Why is this up here?
This is uncomfy. It's to pull things through the attic door.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, like, that makes sense.
And
we literally didn't have an attic growing up.
I just hate, it's so uncomfy that we're supposed to believe from the shots we get that he hooks her in the face and hoists her up by a hook in her face.
The way she gets sucked up into the attic when that hook hits her.
And then, right after that murder, unnecessary temper tantrum from Attic Boy?
Oh, yeah. He just starts running around and destroying objects in the attic. And again, a lot of weird shit up in this attic that should not be here.
Mm-hmm.
Like children's toys. Really, really old furniture.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you'd think if it was a sorority house, they would have just cleaned all that shit out. And Ross, I honestly think he's keeping their bodies in the attic with him for company.
Yeah.
I really do.
Spalding and Coven energy. Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So the search party finds that poor 13-year-old girl, rest in peach.
That's definitely connected, right? Like, he definitely killed that little girl, right?
See,
They don't ever say that he does, though.
That's the thing. We don't get a manner of death, as in, did she slip and fall or was she killed? And there's just something inside of me that doesn't think that Billy did that.
Well,
Billy is reclusive and elusive. In order to attack her and go after her, he would have to go out into broad daylight around other people. She went missing in the middle of the day.
Well, it doesn't mean that he necessarily killed her then. He could have waited to... See, I think he did it to distract.
I mean, it's possible.
I think he did it to distract away from what's going on in the house.
Okay, all right, that's a theory.
It keeps the authorities busy, you know, like... So the phone rings again, right?
Obscene phone call number 3.
It's the moaner.
Jess comes home and answers the ringing phone. And these calls just get more and more desperate.
Hello? Hello? Who is this?
Please stop. Help me.
This is giving ventriloquist energy. Like, well, how is he throwing his voice like that? How's he doing all those voices?
Right?
Like, and you know, Jess is like, okay, it's time to get the authorities involved. And so she reports the moaner to the authorities. And Carrie, just putting this random pin right here, the stairs are carpeted red.
Yeah, because we see the shot behind her of the stairs, and there's a shadow on the stairs.
Yep.
And you start to panic, because you think this is going to happen now.
Mm-hmm.
And guys, it's Peter. Peter let himself into the sorority house.
Hee-hee.
Or at least that's what he claimed.
I did not hear you come in. How did you get in here?
This is where they're obviously trying to hint at the fact that Peter might be the man making the phone calls or the man scooting around the house out of sight. Like, the guy on the phone even kind of sounds like Peter.
Peter is here
to
tell Jess he's quitting the conservatory and they're gonna get married.
He's telling her.
Like, they're just making the decision. You know who else did that?
Who?
The Golden State Killer.
What?
To Bonnie.
Oh, told his wife that...
Remember that?
Uh-huh.
Because he was like, we're going to get married. And Bonnie was like, I don't want to.
And he was like,
I'll kill you for this.
Oh, no.
Sorry that I keep bringing this Golden State Killer thing into it.
No, I think it's relevant.
I think the Golden State Killer is like the premier example for these 70s serial killers.
Yeah.
You know, like just in terms of the sheer depravity and horror that they visited upon their victims. Like,
yeah.
And there's just a lot of parallels there. Sorry I keep bringing it up. And she's like, hey, you know when we first got together? Jess says to Peter, you know when we first got together? And
I hate this exchange.
We agreed that, you know, there. You told me that your biggest dream was to be a concert pianist and it was the one thing you wanted. Well, did you know that I also had a lot of dreams and I'm not willing to put that all on hold to marry you right now?
I still want to do those things. You can't ask me to drop everything I've been working for and give up all my ambitions because your plans have changed. Be realistic. I can't marry you.
Sure you can. What does it change? We could be married. You could still do anything you wanted to do.
Peter, I don't want to marry you.
But the thing that irks me is that we don't get to hear about those things she wants. Just the things he wants, which is just so typical.
Well, it's 1974, Carrie.
I know. It's like when they were sketching out characters, they wrote under Final Girl, British, and then decided that was enough.
Yeah, for all we know, Olivia Hussey's character's dreams are to be hot and Olivia Hussey for the rest of her life. You know, and like, she's like, when she's like, listen, I don't want to marry you.
Yeah.
Which is very brave.
It is.
I'm sorry that that's the way it is, but it is brave of her to tell him that because he's already disconcerting and controlling.
And then he completely turns over.
You selfish bitch.
You're talking about killing our baby as though you were having a wart removed.
Now can you see why I didn't want to tell you?
What the hell are you trying to do to me?
What are you doing to yourself?
Let's get one thing straight. You are not going to abort that baby.
Peter, you're not going to tell me what I can and cannot do.
Jess, if you try getting an abortion...
I think you better leave.
If you try getting an abortion...
I said get out.
Yeah, it's not good. And she throws him out. And the thing is, we do see him physically leave. We'll come back to that later, but we do see him physically leave.
The cops are putting some things together, aren't they, Carrie?
Yeah, Fuller is finally connecting the dots. The murder in the park, Claire disappearing, and the obscene phone calls all might be related.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to call over to the sorority house, right? Fuller, this part sends me because Fuller looks at the piece of paper that Nash wrote down the fake phone number on. Fellatio, right?
Yeah, and all these, you know, all these law enforcement officers do is get paid to laugh, so...
No, this is so funny, because he calls Nash over there.
What's this?
Well, that's the number at the sorority house.
Fellatio?
Yeah, it's a new exchange. F.E.
New exchange?
Yeah, fellatio. One of the girls that was in this afternoon gave it to me.
She gave it to you?
Yeah.
Nash, I don't think you could pick your nose without written instructions.
No. No, Nash. It's oral sex. Like,
the way that other detective sounds like he will die from wheezing.
His character is called the Laughing Detective. In the credits.
I would also be laughing my ass off. Nash, I don't think you could pick your nose without written instructions.
Yeah, like...
Then why is he the desk sergeant? The desk sergeant, Ross, is kind of like the equivalent of what our mother does at the surgery center. They're like a hub of information and activity. How is he in charge of this? So, because he obviously doesn't have the correct number, Fuller shows up at the house with Chris, Phil, Mr. Harrison, and a guy from the phone company.
Which, he got that done fast. We can get so many things done fast, but other things we'll just ignore altogether.
Yep. And the guy from the phone company is going to put a trace on the downstairs phones.
He's tapping the phones.
Because there's another phone in Mrs. Mack's room, but that hasn't gotten any calls, so there's nothing there. We're not going to put a trace on that one.
Fuller's also here to talk about Claire.
Yeah, he's looking at Claire's room, asking Jess and Phil a bunch of very cursory questions about Claire's habits. Like, you know, is she the kind of girl that would run off? Is she the kind of girl that parties too much? And they're like, no, she's totally chill. None of this makes sense. And the thing is that no one even knows to ask where Mrs. Mack is because they think she's at her sister's.
Yeah, they think she's gone.
So that's definitely not being investigated.
And no one's going in the attic because it's the attic and it's scary up there. And, you know, it is scary up there at the time being, but, you know, this Grant guy from the telecom or whatever.
He is a lineman for the county.
He tells...
Sorry.
Please. What the fuck? He tells Jess and Phil they have to keep the moaner on the phone the next time that he calls. They need to keep him on the phone as long as humanly possible in order to create the trace.
The archaic explanation of how the phone trace works.
How's it going? You about finished?
Yeah, what I've done is I've tapped this phone so that when it rings, it'll ring at the station house, too. At the same time, I'll be at the phone company checking on the location of the source of the call. Are there any other phones in the house?
Yes, the house mother has a
line. Yeah, but it's another number and there haven't been any calls in it.
You're going to have to keep this guy on the line as long as possible. We got a mechanical system here and it takes a while. I know it's not very pleasant.
Guys, I tried to look into it. The internet was not helpful, but it was a very physical process in those days.
It's phone magic. How about that? It's just phone magic.
So before he leaves, Fuller also lets the girls know that they put a patrolman out in front of the house.
Jennings!
Yeah, so no oogity boogities can come in from outside.
Wave hi to Jennings now, because you won't have another opportunity.
Chris and Harrison leave because it's a sorority house. They can't sleep there. And this is where poor Phil has a little breakdown.
Yeah, Phil is breaking down because she can't see how Claire is not dead.
Yeah.
And, you know, she asks Jess, you know, hey, are you going to be okay? Because, like, I have a cold and I'm very exhausted. Can I leave you up? Can I go to bed, please? And Jess is like, sure, I'll be fine. It'll be great. She's standing, Phil, while she's crying. She's sitting down or standing in front of that astrology poster. That red astrology poster.
It's Aries.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then right before she ascends the stairs, she's standing in front of that poster. And I hate this because Phil is my fave.
I know.
She has showed the most humanity throughout this whole thing when she's crying and say how bad she feels for Mr. Harrison.
Oh, God, James. Just know Claire is dead. I can just feel it. Oh,
come on now, Phil. We don't know that.
Poor Mr. Harrison. I feel so sorry for him.
Hey.
It's Christmas.
Yeah.
A missing persons case at Christmas?
This sucks.
It literally is the worst.
So now it's just Jess downstairs alone waiting for the phone to ring. And because of the tap, the phone will also ring at the police station so Fuller can hear everything that's being said. And while she's waiting down there, Billy goes into Barb's room. Barb is in a drunken sleep, and I'm sure comes to with him standing over her, but she's so drunk she can't move, and then she begins to have an asthma attack.
Easy, relax. It'll be okay. It's okay. It's okay.
Jess rushes to her aid. And what does Barb have on?
A red nightgown.
Yeah, sexy red nightgown.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And also, no Billy. He's gone. He's evaporated.
And so Jess gets Barb her inhaler, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she gets her calmed down. But guess who's here? Fucking Christmas carolers.
The note I took was, Christmas caroling is one of the most profoundly strange traditions I've ever heard of in my life. Remember in Christmas in the Cranks when they were literally trying to hide from them? Like, if you want to go stand in the town square with a group of people and sing some carols, that's fine. But, like, it's the going from house to house.
I'm singing. I'm at your front door and I'm singing. I'm at your front door and I'm singing.
And Jess opens up the door to listen, and this will be the creepy sound cover for poor Barb's murder. Because Billy goes back into Barb's room, and Barb on her headboard, I love 70s headboards, man, with the shelves behind it, and she's got a collection of little glass animals.
And he's saying, Agnes, it's me, Billy.
What the fuck does that mean?
Who is Agnes? Who's Billy? I know it's him, but, like, I didn't know at this point. Like,
I can't believe you're really going to make me wait to the end to explain it, but
anyway,
I get it.
You know, for a psychopathic murderer, his nails sure are clean and trimmed.
Yeah.
Just saying. And this is what made me still think it's Peter.
I know.
Like, this is what made me think it's Peter. Look at those hands. Only a pianist would have manicured hands like that.
And guys, he picks up this very large glass bust of a unicorn and literally uses the horn to stab her to death.
It's kind of funny. And it's not funny because it is funny. It's just funny because I'm looking at this with 2020 vision.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's just, that's why it's funny to me.
It's a gay way to die.
Gay
ways to die. So the pattern seems to be that after each murder, he has to make a telephone call. And this time, Billy is making noises like he is a child wailing, and the child is arguing with this other adult voice.
And they're talking about a baby.
Yeah.
They're talking about a baby. Like, what's wrong with the baby? Where's the baby?
Removed. Oh my God.
Yeah, No, it's totally Peter.
Those were Peter's exact words.
About the fetus that Jess wants to abort inside her. Like,
and like, but the thing is that phone call wasn't long enough to get a trace. So that was a bust.
But Fuller, also being tapped to the phone, still was listening to it.
Yeah.
And so
the way he calls back and he's like, what the hell? Does this happen like this every time?
Yeah.
And she's like, yeah, it's been pretty bad.
And she omits recognizing Peter's phrase from him.
Yeah, and when Phil wakes up to come back downstairs and check on the situation, she's like, why didn't you tell him that? And Jess is like, well, I don't really know for sure, and I don't want to start that whole rigmarole if I'm not sure. And, like, even Phil doesn't think it's Peter.
This is where I took this note. I said it earlier, but this is where I took it. This film is very balanced between natural and cinematic. And I find that very satisfying. Like, it's dramatic, but also scary. For my first time, I'm really enjoying it.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad.
Peter calls crying because he thinks he's religious and doesn't want her to have an abortion.
Which...
And, like, none of the calls are lasting long enough. And so this time, Fuller hears the abortion conversation once he taps into that call.
Mm-hmm.
So Fuller finds out about the baby drama and immediately confronts Jess about it.
Yeah, after Peter hangs up, he calls back and goes, Jess?
You need to tell me everything you know.
You want to tell me what that was about?
So Fuller is now suspecting Peter and wants to talk to him. I just want to talk to him. I just want to talk to him.
But the thing is that Fuller also asks her, was Peter present anytime one of these calls came in? And Jess, almost as if she's experienced a wave of relief, is like, wait.
Yes, he was here. He was at the house tonight when the first call came. That's right. It couldn't be Peter. Phil, it couldn't be Peter. He was here.
Well, he's obviously upset about something. I'd like to talk to him. Can you tell me where I might reach him?
Well, he lives at Baker House, but when he gets like this, he usually goes down to the recital hall at the music conservatory and plays.
This is where I took the note. This film has it all. Intrigue, crime, an investigation, horror, murder,
fashion.
And then I went, calm down.
Fashion,
yeah.
You type calm down to yourself.
I did, calm down. Don't be this person. Because, like, Phil has reemerged from her room. What is she wearing, Carrie?
A red nightgown.
A red floral nightgown.
I hate you for noticing that.
I kept seeing the red on everybody, and I was like, I'm loving this stylistic choice. We're marking them for death. But then there's something in the greens, too, and I don't know what it is. There's the green telephone. There's the green wreaths on all of their bedroom doors. I know it's Christmas. We obviously understand what the red is signifying.
But what is the green signifying?
I still don't know. What
Peter wears a green sweater through most of the movie.
Yeah, what's with the green? I don't know.
Again, the symbol.
Ooh, spooky Christmas, red and green.
The shortest answer is, it's Christmas.
Sure, yeah, you're right, you're absolutely right. So Phil's in her red nightgown.
That scene where they're in the kitchen and those search party guys come to the window and scare the shit out of them.
Oh yeah, the guys from the search party.
We can blow through this pretty quick because there's really only two things you need to take away from it. One, this is setting up the fact that there are people swarming the area. It's very unlikely that the threat would be coming from outside, seeing as how there are people everywhere.
So these search party yahoos are like, you ladies better lock up the whole house, windows and doors, like everything.
And remember, there might be others from the search party around, so yeah. Don't be afraid. We'll be around to say that you're safe.
Good enough. Thank you very much.
Just remember to lock those doors and windows down, Dave.
Okay, then.
Bye-bye. Bye now.
I'd rather face the killer. No, seriously, do you realize this is the only door and window in this whole house that's locked?
And I wrote, what?
Come on!
Even at this stage of the scenario, that's the only one that's locked? So that's what they do. They set to lock in all the doors and windows in the house.
One more note about this exchange with the search party, guys. It's weird to see Canadians with guns. That shotgun that guy's got in his hand? Well, you better lock up your house, eh?
Ross, they might have to shoot a bull moose in their backyard.
Exactly.
And so Phil is upstairs, closing all the upstairs windows, and she hears Barb's bedroom door closing.
The wreath decorated with one-shooters, empty one-shot bottles.
She opens it slightly, and there's Barb dead in her bed. And guys, Billy just closes the door behind her.
He's behind the door. And I'm like, no, they got her. They got my Phil.
She doesn't make a lick of noise either.
I know.
You know why, though? That's so simple. Because if she had made a lick of noise, Jess would have heard it, and none of the rest of this movie would have happened.
We do have that real quick shot where Fuller finds the upset piano in the recital hall.
The destroyed piano.
And he's like, okay, it probably is this Peter dude, right?
Yeah. Back at the house, we've got phone call number 5. We actually see this one being made from a phone that is sitting on a table next to a record album that says McHenry's Sisters Vaudeville on it.
I feel like this plays into the, like, this is what I was talking about earlier. I feel like this plays into the deeper lore of Black Christmas for some reason. I was almost wondering to myself, okay, maybe this Agnes person is related to Mac somehow. Mm-hmm. This is Mac's house, right? Like,
I don't know if she owns it.
Well, all of her shit's in it. So,
but obviously we recognize that. We know who that is.
Mm-hmm.
And so the guy at the phone company is hauling ass between these terminals, trying to figure out which one's jumping around. I literally wish I understood how this works. I don't even know what he's looking for.
And again, this call. Multiple voices and the where's the baby, where's Agnes, and screaming Billy's name.
Mommy, come here. Where's Agnes? Agnes.
Hey, mommy, there's a baby. Baby, all right, mommy.
This is Graham. It's group 140, terminal 55.
The lineman finally finds the correct terminal.
The trace is in.
And then he gets on the line with Desk Sergeant Nash, who then has to radio Fuller in the patrol car because he's out at the conservatory. And Fuller is in the patrol car with another guy, and Nash buzzes him and says, "They got it, sir. They got it."
A phone company's on the other line, sir. They say they got a trace on this one.
Yeah, let's have it.
He says the calls are coming from number 6 Belmont Street.
For Christ's sakes, Nash, you got it wrong. That's where the calls are going into.
That's where they're coming from, too, sir.
The sound of the piano is literally the personification of my elevator falling. And the thing is Fuller tries to radio the guy sitting out front.
Jennings!
Yeah, poor Jennings, who is a no-line character.
Now, when did Billy have time to go outside and slit his throat?
He's dead in the front seat!
He's
dead in the front seat!
He's dead as hell in that car.
Mech dead! So Fuller gets back on the radio, and I love this exchange for some reason.
I can't get through to Jennings. I want you to call that girl. Nash, be calm. Don't tell her that the guy's in the house. Just tell her to put down the phone and walk straight out the front door. I'll be there in 5 minutes. Nash, if you blow this, I'll kill you.
In the house, Jess is calling for Phil. No answer, but the phone rings. It's Nash. This is the famous fucking incident from this movie.
This moment here is the entire reason I wanted to cover this and not the 06 version. Well, not the entire reason, but it's the best reason.
Sergeant Nash is calling Jess to tell her to leave the house. So do me a favor, okay? No questions. Nope. You don't ask me any questions.
Now just put the phone back on the hook, walk to the front door, and leave the house.
What's wrong?
Please, Miss Bradford, please just do as I tell you.
Okay.
I'll get Phil and Bob.
No, don't do that, Jess. Jess, the caller is in the house.
The calls are coming from the house.
Jess,
get up.
Few moments like this in horror hit me the way this does.
You have actual goosebumps.
It's the
slow turn.
Yeah.
To the horrifying shot of the empty stairs.
Yeah, there's someone in the house, and I don't know how they got in, and they've been here the whole time.
Jess goes to the front door.
She's going to leave, but then she just can't leave without Phil and Barb.
Okay.
So
when we see the fire poke, my brain immediately was like, when a stranger calls, when a stranger calls.
Yes.
The fucking fire poke.
She arms herself with a fireplace poker and decides to do the dumb white girl thing and go investigate.
She can't leave them.
I know.
Phil! Bob! Oh, please answer me. Phil! Bob! Please answer me! Please answer me! Please!
Oh, oh. As we go through the end of this here, the level of Mick Reddy that Jess is not was honestly a little impressive.
Yeah.
Like, I know that it's probably just Olivia Hussey acting it weirdly, or strangely, I should say. But, like, she goes to Barb's door, right?
Mm-hmm.
Opens it up. And there's Barb and Phil, cuddled up in bed together.
Dead.
Bloody and dead.
Mm.
And she kind of like falls to the floor. And then Carrie, when she looks up because she hears him talking, and it's the shot of his eye staring down at her in between the door jamb and the door.
Agnes, it's me, Billy. Agnes, don't you tell what we did, Agnes.
She does not scream. She does not gasp.
I know. She's not Mick Reddy.
She just pushes that door onto him and takes off down the stairs.
This is the most terrifying part to me.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
Because he chases her and he's screaming the whole time he's chasing her. She, by a hair, locks herself in the basement stairwell. And it's the way he is banging, trying to get at her through that door, screaming at her. He stops abruptly, and she can hear him slowly and calmly walk away.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so abrupt.
It's like something turned over.
Yeah.
And she hears the front door open and close.
And then who's here trying to get into the basement through the window?
It's Peter.
So the killer's Peter, right? It's Peter?
Like, she's cowering in the basement and he is, you know, wiping the frost off the glass so he can see down there like, Jess? Jess? Where are you? And he breaks a window. And, like, it's all making sense for her because Peter could have definitely made that call that she thought he couldn't have made because he was upstairs on Mrs. Mack's phone. It's all coming to her in this moment. And he is walking around the basement saying her name. And she is under the stairs clutching that fireplace poker. And he finally spots her.
He's acting like a sociopath.
Yeah.
Like, his... I don't know. That's how sociopaths behave in situations like this where they're intentionally making people uncomfortable. They take pleasure in it, and they show it to you because it makes you uncomfortable. He's smiling at her.
Jess. Why didn't you answer me? What are you yelling about? Jess, you had me worried. What are you doing down here?
To the cops rolling up to 6 Belmont and, like, we're like, what's going, what happened? We didn't see anything. They finally bust down the basement door and find Jess under the stairs with Peter dead in her lap.
Yeah, she beat him to death with the fire poke. And you know what? One less problem.
Oh my God.
Sorry, I know that Peter's a human being, but he's kind of a fuck, and not that that means he deserves to die, but, like, I'm fine with him out of the picture.
Oh, man. And, guys, I hate the way this movie makes you think everything's fine.
Because everyone's like, it was Peter, right? It was totally Peter. Great.
This last scene of the movie is fascinating because it's all long shots. And it starts in Jess's bedroom. The doctor's giving her a sedative and put her to sleep in her bed. And there's all these people around, cops talking about how, yeah, it was definitely Peter. Even though they're not sure why he suddenly went postal. They can't explain that. We think we can as an audience because of, you know, Jess wanting to have an abortion and his recital not going well. So we think we can explain it. And the cops start to peel out of the house one by one because they've all got what they need now. We'll let her sleep. Chris and the doctor are supposed to stay with her. But Mr. Harrison, for some reason, has a fainting spell. And they decide that even though he is not the one who had to murder his boyfriend in self-defense, he should definitely go to the hospital, right? Where is the decision-making on that?
All right, Lieutenant, will do.
Hey, Lieutenant.
Hey, you. Come on, out, out. You want to spend the night in the can? Move. Jesus, what's the matter with this guy?
He's suffering from shock. We have to get him to the hospital. Can you get us a car, Nash?
Yeah, let's go.
It's this shot that starts in Jess's bedroom. It shifts to Barb's bedroom, where we can see the blood-stained, unsheeted mattress that both of their bodies were laying on. Then it pans to Claire's bedroom. We can see that horrifying squishmallow on her bed.
The pumpkin that's seen some shit.
And then we see the end of the hallway, where the attic door is. And we can hear him. We can still hear him up there, giggling.
And you can hear that rocking chair going.
Agnes, it's me, Billy.
He's still there and no one is in the house with her.
No one has found Max and Claire's bodies, which are in the attic.
No, even though there's a Frogger in here. Why did no one think to check the attic? And the last shot is of both Mrs. Mac and poor Claire in the attic window. And it's pulling out through the window her face with the lit candle next to it. Literally, if that cop on the street bothered to look up, he would see her. And just, and the way the phone starts ringing again. I'm not okay with any of that.
Yeah, no, that was good. That was really good. Let's have this conversation, please.
Okay, all right.
So, I'm hearing about this Agnes character. I'm hearing, obviously, he's Billy.
Mm-hmm.
Why is he breaking into this house? Just answer my questions. Why is he breaking into the house?
Okay, so, I know you're going to hate this, but I'm going to answer this question in two phases. Stop it!
I want to know the specific information I want to know.
I know, and I'm getting to it, okay?
No, it's going to be a whole dissertation. Like,
you mean like JFK was?
Oh. Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. You're 100% right about that.
Okay.
You know what? I'm going to go ahead and step out because I was wrong for that. Thank you. Sorry.
May I continue?
Yep.
Okay. So, what the lore in the original film is left deliberately ambiguous. What you may or may not be able to extrapolate from it is that one thing about the house is obviously there's a bunch of junk in it that doesn't look like it belongs there, right? So one thing you could extrapolate from that is this was an old house that the university bought for the purpose of it being a sorority house, like from the bank or something.
Mm-hmm.
It had everybody's shit in it still. And then you can kind of see how it's very possible that Billy lived here, grew up here. And that's why not only does he fixate on it and target it, but why he also knows the layout really well.
Mm-hmm.
Think about how much he was able to move around unseen. It's because he lived there. That's one thing you can take from that. I'm sure your next question is, who the fuck are Billy and Agnes?
Well, he's Billy.
Yeah, he identifies himself as Billy, but who is Agnes? again, what you might be able to extrapolate from these phone calls is that Billy and Agnes grew up in that house together. They were...
I couldn't.
I'm saying you might be able to, not that you should have been able to. This is stuff that's been debated on the internet for years,
so,
literally.
So, Billy and Agnes are what?
Brother and sister, it seems.
Okay.
And that when they were children, Billy did a really terrible thing.
To a baby?
To a baby.
A sibling of theirs?
Uh-huh. And then said, Agnes, don't tell them what we did. You know, don't tell Mom and Dad. Yeah. And so that is the base lore of that you could reasonably, you know.
It's like with the babysitter and the man upstairs.
A little.
Because famously in that legend, the man upstairs calls in and asks the babysitter if she's checked the children.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes in to find the children dead.
I hate it.
And maybe that's, I don't know, drawing that to the baby?
Mm-hmm.
Like, not protecting the baby? Maybe Agnes was supposed to be babysitting and, like, let Billy, the man upstairs, well, the boy, that is,
mm-hmm.
hurt the baby, like...
Yeah, I think that's all rational. No, well, it's not rational, but I think you could make a case for that.
Well, you're also hearing other screaming voices that he's imitating.
It's Mom and Dad.
It sounds like parents.
Yeah, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Did the parents come home and find their dead baby and wonder what the other two kids could have possibly been doing? This is why you don't charge children with looking after other children!
Anyway.
Sorry. Okay, so like a murder from the past resurfacing in this sociopath.
Yep. And in the 06 movie, they just took that vague backstory and they wrung as much horrific detail out of it they possibly could. I will quickly synopsize, I promise. JFK.
Okay.
So in that movie, the sorority sisters, they actually like do a fun little tradition with Billy. They leave Billy a present because he's a part of the history of their house. Billy lived there when he was a little boy. Billy was born jaundiced and his mother shunned him for that reason. His mother actually murders his father in front of him with her lover. They bury him under the porch. And just as a habit, start keeping Billy locked upstairs in the attic because they don't want to deal with him. And then, this is horrible, trigger warning, the mother actually sexually assaults Billy, and conceives a child with him. That is Agnes. Agnes is his daughter's sister. Yeah, it's bad.
I wish you guys could see the look on my face.
It's bad. This is why I didn't want to cover that movie, because you would be so icked by these details.
Oh, no, I've seen Flowers in the Attic.
Stop.
I'm sorry.
And then, you know, they dote on Agnes and leave Billy chained in the attic, and then eventually another baby is conceived. And Billy, one Christmas, murders his mother, his stepfather, and then literally uses cookie cutters to take bits of their flesh out and make Christmas cookies with them. That's how the cops find him.
That is enough.
I know. This is.
I loved this movie. So glad we didn't do the remake.
I'm glad that we made this choice. Because that would have taken you over the top, and you would never have spoken to me again.
That is enough.
Aren't you glad I didn't do that to you?
Where are you, Black Christmas? Why are you awful? No, not Black Christmas the movie, but The Happenings. All right, guys, Christmas horror well underway. Thanks for sitting through our first selection. Oh, and we've got a lot more great, creepy Christmas content coming at you this season.
I don't know what that was.
Oh, that's what it sounded like.
Yeah.
It sounded like Wizard of Oz.
Guys, next week we will be covering the 1984 comedy horror film, Gremlins.
Merry Christmas, little onions. Don't feed us after midnight.
Absolutely not.
Be on the lookout for that next week, folks.
In the meantime, you can go follow us on Twitter at KickNStream.
KickNStream.
You can write the show at kickingandstreamingpodcast@gmail.com.
That is with an and, not an ampersand.
And don't forget, folks, please go check out the Patreon. Please, 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 please. We want you guys to see all the good work we're doing over there right now.
Exactly. It's not no work, guys. So go show Carrie Ann how much you care. More quality content coming to you from Kicking and Streaming.
Until then, I'm Carrie.
I'm not.
And as always,
sorry, Mom.